Hi, today's August 26, 2017. This is Mobile News Podcast number 219. I'm Paolo Gossowart, my good friend John Westfall, and today we have a special guest, our good buddy Don Sorcinelli. Hey, Don.
Hey, everybody.
I am going to... Boy, I tell you, this audio hijack... Or no, it's not an audio hijack, it's my microphone. So, okay, I had to replug in my headset. So, before we start recording, I can only hear you if my headset is plugged into the microphone. After we start recording, I can only hear if I'm plugged into the Mac.
I'd like to point out that my very sophisticated microphone setup now is a pair of stock Apple AirPods. And I have none of these problems.
Well, what can I say? It's, you know, it's a good microphone. It makes me sound, I think, better. You know, because I need all the help I can get, of course. But boy, I tell you, it is wacky. And I'm looking at my settings, and it says USB audio, advanced audio device for speakers and microphone, and yet... Anywho, it's me, Don, John. I'm the only one whose name doesn't end in O-N, but that's okay.
You have an O, though, so you're okay.
Yeah. Anywho, first thing is a couple of weather-related news items I wanted to talk about, especially since I know Don and I have both lived in hurricane areas. I still live in one. And that is, there's a new website I learned about called windy.com, W-I-N-D-Y.com. It's pretty cool. It figures out where you were, where you are, and shows you an animated wind graphic, where the winds are blowing, what direction, that sort of thing. It's really kind of fun to watch. And, of course, being hurricane season here and elsewhere, it's kind of important for us. We've been very fortunate this year, by the way. Normally this time of year in August, by mid-August, late August, we've probably had a couple of scares here in Hawaii. But this year, zero. They all kind of peter out before they reach us. On the other hand, the folks in on the coast of Texas have been hit pretty hard this weekend, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and this past week for me was... reminder, it was the 25th anniversary of Andrew, which I was in South Florida when that one hit. And because it's the 25th, there were a lot of remembrances and videos put out. And it's amazing every time you see. That's when I saw Harvey was when it reached Category 4 strength.
Yeah.
You start to remember back and you think to yourself, if somebody's on windy.com with a Category 4, I'm sure the animation says, why are you looking at your computer screen? Yeah. You should be in an interior room with no windows.
Right. Get the heck out of wherever you are.
Yes. Stop watching the cute animation. Yeah. Go inside.
Yeah. Go far away from the coast.
Yeah.
And as mentioned, this is not a hurricane that starts with I, so it will not bother me. I'm safe. It was Hurricane Irene in 2012 that hit New York, and I was living just north of the city at that time. And it was Hurricane Isaac a couple years later that, when I was in Louisiana, it hit down by New Orleans, and I just got a lot of rain from it. I always get rain, but the next hurricane is going to be Hurricane Irma or Tropical Storm Irma, so that's the one that I'll be worried about.
Yeah,
and I'll try that's
roll right up the Mississippi River and hit me.
It's tracking you.
By the way, yep. John, just to let you know, I am in the same alphabet boat as you because the last two hurricanes that either touched where I live or hit nearby were Iniki and Eva, so both start with I.
Yep.
You guys have issues. I don't know. You've got I issues, not me.
Yeah. Anyhow, windy.com is a really interesting website. We've been having problems with lack of wind here, interestingly enough. And it gets really hot, humid, and uncomfortable when we have lack of our trade winds. Right now, it's not too bad. But next couple of days, I think the wind's going to die down. So lots of interest for us. Now, the other interesting I found out, and it's I was not aware of this because we don't have any Waffle Houses in Hawaii. I don't know if they have any where you are up in the Northeast, Don, or where you are.
No, Don. But I was originally down south.
So you're familiar with it. So apparently Waffle House is a 7x24 operation. It never shuts down. And FEMA has an internal index. It's not published, but they have an internal index that they use. That if a waffle, and so it's red, green, red, amber, green. So if it's green, the Waffle House is open. If it's amber, they have limited service. And if it's red, the Waffle House is closed, which means They're in some deep trouble. And anyway, 538.com has a really interesting article and some history on this unpublished index. Basically, it's the title is "If Waffle House is closed, it's time to panic."
Especially if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you're in a college town.
Yeah.
You may not remember that Waffle House was closed the night before, the next morning, but at the time you will panic.
Yeah. So, anyways, it's interesting. It's an interesting index because it's real life stuff, right? Where are you going to get food? If if you don't have power, and
if you're at Waffle House, you're desperate for food already.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it good? Is it bad? Like I said, never been to one.
I would say 538. Well, there's a couple things 538 should analyze with regards to Waffle House. Number one is the blood alcohol level of the average patron after midnight of a Waffle House. And then they could probably correlate that to another study when you ask Todd how good Waffle House food is.
Yeah.
At 2 o'clock in the morning with a high blood level, alcohol level, it's fantastic. the next morning you'll wonder what the heck was I doing, but that's Waffle House for you.
But anyway, it's an interesting article at 530.com. I recommend people read it. People are interested in weather-related kind of indices. I found it fascinating how Waffle House gets things up and running with no electricity, no water. Sort of, if we can get people into the Waffle House, we'll start serving food, basically.
If they can stagger in, yeah, we'll serve them.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting corporate philosophy there. But, it's important, right? When you in your home have no food and water or whatever, it's good to be able to get to somewhere where you can get some, hot food in your system. And speaking of food, hot or otherwise, John and I discussed this earlier, Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods is closing on Monday, I guess. And the word is that prices are going to start dropping on some items in Whole Foods immediately. And at some point, I don't know when, Amazon Prime members are going to get special member discounts. And some stores are even going to have Amazon lockers, which I think is a great idea. I guess I'm speaking from you two. I'm the only one with the Whole Foods near me. No Waffle House, but I got a Whole Foods.
Yeah. You folks have your priorities correct. Let me tell you.
So, I have a Whole Foods about 5 miles from me. So, I'm looking for... And as I mentioned to you two before we started recording, I don't go there that often, maybe a handful of times per year.
Yeah.
But with lower prices, maybe I will go more often.
I'll be curious to see how they plan on working the Prime member discounts. If it's just going to be a flat rate discount, or I'm more inclined to think they're going to do it like other products. They're going to do just like they might have flyers at your local grocery store for coupons and things. Maybe there's something that they have with relation to that might be, something different.
Yeah, maybe it'll be a combo of things, so people who buy salmon also buy starfruit, and you'll get a discount if you buy that combo of things. So we'll see.
Yeah.
But,
buy
the folks,
these three things together and then review them.
That's right.
Verified purchasing.
Right?
Well, and you mentioned it, and this goes back to when they first made the acquisition. It's funny that there's going to be some Amazon lockers. I still also believe there will be some, we might see some things in the way of using their distribution centers to just further Amazon's distribution channels.
Oh, yeah.
When you think about it, grocery retailers have very sophisticated networks for distribution purposes, and I'm wondering if they're looking at leveraging that beyond just the grocery store.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this because as I said, we have a nearby Whole Foods. What you said, Don, is exactly what I was wondering about. Because they not only get brick and mortar store, that means they have kind of warehousing or a distribution system now that is hyper local. So, even way out here in the middle of nowhere, I wonder if we're going to start to have same-day delivery. Amazon Prime, by the way, does not do overnight here. In fact, I usually get things about 10 days after I order it in Amazon Prime. So,
I'd be in trouble there. Yeah. Sorry, Todd. I'm not moving your way anytime soon. There's certain things where I draw the line, and no two-day Amazon Prime. Yeah. That's one of them.
Yeah. So also, we can't get any batteries out here of any kind. So I can't I can't buy Anker portable USB chargers or anything like that through Amazon anyway. So
legally.
Well, yeah. I mean, we can get them. We just can't get them through Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, Costco.
Well,
you know,
go to Costco. Their ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am.
Yeah, I haven't tried Monoprice or anything, but I know Amazon. You can't even get things like, God, what was somebody telling me? Hair gel. I think you can't, they won't sell hair gel to you via Amazon. To, you know, why?
Well, that's just a good idea. But, you know, that just saves, you know, people's, I suppose, self-appearance nightmares that they'll look back from 10 years later and go, what was I thinking? So that's just a public service.
And I don't know about aerosols. But anyway, there's a bunch of stuff we cannot ship here to Hawaii via Amazon purchase. You can get them, just not through Amazon. But at any rate, so Monday, I may just pop, you know, like I said, I think, let's see, this is August. I've probably been to Whole Foods 3 times this year. I may make it number 4 on Monday just to see what's going on over there.
This is 2017, and I've never been in a Whole Foods.
Well, you don't have one near you.
Even when I lived near one, I just never bothered. All the foods I've gotten have seemed pretty whole to me. So I haven't seen the selling point quite yet.
John, I think your microphone is buried in your collar or something.
That's possible.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, the other thing, too, when you mentioned that, the part about lowering prices is going to be interesting, too, because that's still, I mean, the running joke that people call Whole Foods whole paycheck.
Exactly.
You know, now of course they still obviously have premium product, but yeah, I'm going to watch with a lot of curiosity the two things between the prices and then what they do with Prime. It'll be fascinating.
Right, and of course it's weird that, you know, Amazon, the company that how should I put it in a way that's not pejorative? Led to the destruction of brick-and-mortar stores. Okay, I have no other way to say it. I mean, basically, they changed the face of retail, right?
Right.
And, you know, whether or not it's good or bad, it's, you know, your call. But basically...
Well, they changed the face of retail for non-perishable things.
Yeah, yeah.
And while they have opened brick-and-mortar, which I still don't understand, the brick-and-mortar stores, the bookstores... But this groceries are the one area that obviously hyper-local is almost a necessity because it's perishable items. So, but I wonder, again, I'll be very curious to see how they leverage physical location in ways beyond just distribution of perishable items. Do they use it more for like you said, lockers, Amazon lockers? Right. Do they use it more for better distribution channels?
Right.
It's going to be fascinating to watch some of the different.
My other theory, by the way, and maybe this is part of conspiracy views, but my other theory is that the Whole Foods are going to be used as helipads for Amazon's drones. Right? If you're going to have drones, you need real estate to launch them from. And
back to that physical location. There you go.
Yeah.
I believe that is definitely true, and I also think they're going to put the people in charge of the Amazon Fire phone in charge of Whole Foods to run it out of business quickly, and then they'll be able to use all of that real estate just for the drone launching.
What's going to happen if they put the Fire phone people in is they're going to have a grocery store that sells a ton of different groceries that nobody wants.
Yep.
You know, it'll have all the different types of groceries that nobody wants.
Well, you know.
And eventually they'll just start giving them away.
But, you know, if you want a true retail disaster, you need to also add the Microsoft Kin team to the.
they're on retainer for consulting.
Oh, okay, they're consultants? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll see. You know, I, as I said, I am neither a fan nor a anti-fan or whatever you call it of Whole Foods. I go there once in a while, but I know a lot of people love Whole Foods, and no insult to them, but man, it's expensive there at the moment until Monday, apparently. Okay, speaking of changes, another thing I noticed, you know, so I noticed the other day that GIMP, what is GIMP? Graphic Image Manipulation Program. Open source graphics tool released version 2.9.6. And, you know, this used to be a big deal for me in the old days when GIMP released a new version, because graphics programs tended to be expensive and therefore, from my, in my point of view, scarce. So, you know, you had to buy Adobe Photoshop or, you know, one of the other tools, Corel, whatever. PaintShop Pro is, I think, what I bought. Wasn't too expensive. It wasn't like Corel, you know. Wasn't like Photoshop expensive. Yeah. But, you know, it was still $80 or $70, whatever it is. And GIMP is free because it's open source and free. And it was pretty good. It had its idiosyncrasies, but it was pretty important to me. I often used to download it and fuss with it. But, you know, I looked at it, wow, I don't really care anymore. And it's not because I don't do any more image work, but it's just that everything's on the iPad, and the iPad apps are relatively cheap, you know? Even if you pay $10 for an iPad app, it's still orders of magnitude cheaper than Photoshop or PaintShop Pro or whatever else we were using in the old days. So, yeah. I don't know. Do you guys still do graphic stuff on your desktop or notebook?
Yeah, I do. I do. But I've moved between a few, and you're right. It's funny because GIMP, for me, was interesting because there was a time where I still occasionally was working in Linux and using a graphical desktop. And so, yeah, there was a tool there that I could use.
Right.
It's funny that you mentioned PaintShop Pro. I remember when PaintShop Pro was shareware and its price, if you kicked in, was very minimal. And then, one day it got bought up and then bang, it was expensive. And you're right. Now, never mind affordable. There's even, you know, free, depending on your platform. You know, in the .NET, you know, the Windows world, there's paint.net,
which is
really gotten robust.
Yeah.
I also use tools and combine it with other tools that have decent editors built in as part of bigger tools. I use Snagit, for example, for screen capture. Mm-hmm. Snagit's editor is actually pretty nice. So the need to go to GIMP, it was probably about 6 months ago, I set up an old netbook, with, a Linux distro on it. And interestingly enough, I went and grabbed GIMP just so I had something to do any kind of editing or manipulation if I needed it.
Yeah.
But, it still holds that place. I mean, it still holds a certain place, but it's become a lot less, like you said, over time, a lot less of a high priority item.
Yeah, and it's true not only for GIMP, but for other things. Like, for example, I lusted for years for a nice Wacom tablet. But now that I have an iPad Pro with an Apple Pencil, I don't really care. Now, I'm not saying that the iPad Pro is cheap. It's actually probably more expensive than a mid-range Wacom, and it's probably not as good in some respects as it's not as big. On the other hand, I'm drawing directly on the object that I'm touching versus, you know, kind of a distal relationship of drawing on a tablet and looking at a screen. So much more natural interface for me.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that where it's like, don't really care anymore. Not a big deal.
I mean, it's nice to see that it's actually still maintained.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although it's funny though, when I see versioning and I see 2.9.6, does that mean like there's a rev every 3 years or something by this point? You know, a minor rev, never mind a major revision. It's like once a decade would be the case.
Well, you know, but those old open source projects still never, they're not completely comfortable with any major version jump.
They asymptote.
It's just that whole mentality. There's a group of guys and women out there that are in their 50s that are the original open source programmers, and the whole idea of jumping from 2.9.6 to 2.9.6.1 just scares the crap out of them.
I was just about to say, my favorite is always when you get to 0.9 of something and going, will they go 0.10? will they actually roll up a number? And it's always a guess. It's like waiting for that next update. What are they going to do?
Well, you know, as one of the people...
2.99C.
Well, you know, as one of the people who installed Linux 0.9.0.1 from floppy, I think it was 26 floppies when it was released, after you downloaded it. I don't think it hit 1.0 for like 10 years.
There are projects. I mean, look, Apache has been at Apache 2 for, what, 15 years now? 20 years now? I mean,
72 years, actually, as
I mean,
far
we
as
I still think of, I still, and this is the sad part, I still think of Apache 2 as the new Apache. You know, that's just kind of the way that that mentality is. And it's very different from the way that I suppose today we would consider version numbering and, you know, a new version, who cares, this and that. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out when Apache 2 came out, just because I'm curious about
it. Well, on the other hand, at least, and I you know, as an open source fan, I have to stick up for them. At least their numbering is consistent. Versus Microsoft, Windows 7. Well, wait. Windows 95, Windows 98, Windows 2000, Windows XP. They lost the number completely at that point. Windows 7, mm-hmm. Windows 8. Nobody knows what happened in 9. Well, 8, you know, I don't know. 7, 8, 9. I don't know how that, you know, that old joke.
Well, we were told that Windows 9 would have caused the apocalypse if they tried to use it with all the people checking versions for Windows 9. Wild card to see if they were Windows 95, you know. 98. Yeah.
And not to slam just Microsoft, but Apple. Apple has decided 10 is the last number.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's not, the OS no longer even have its number. It was OS 10, OS 10, more OS 10, and then finally just Mac OS.
Yeah.
Suddenly I'm flashed back to Monty Python and the Holy Grail. The number that thou shalt count is 10, no more, no less.
Well, there you go. That's Apple.
It's funny that you mentioned it because, you know, based on the frequency of updates and everything else, when you look at open source or even open, you know, more generalized standards, the same thing, HTML. It was 1994. I think when HTML2 came out. So now it's 2017 and we still haven't gotten 5 standardized yet.
It's not standardized yet? I didn't realize that.
No, it hasn't. Final ratification hasn't. But then again, HTML4 took how many years? And that was always one of the biggest problems I had with, you know, it's the lack of standardization, and everybody who says they are standard based on their concept or definition of standard.
Well, speaking of standards and numbering, I don't want to make anybody wince here, but Bluetooth.
Yeah.
Right? What are we on now? Bluetooth 4? Right? 4.0 or whatever? And it's still flaky as all get out.
I don't know. I read this article years ago that Bluetooth was dead, and I just sort of never looked into it after that.
Well, little
shout out to one of our mutual friends there.
Well, the thing of it is that, yes, Bluetooth has been dead. But again, in my second reference to Monty Python and the Holy Grail, it's the guy on the car. I'm not dead yet.
Yeah.
It doesn't go away. Yeah, it is funny how the open standards, open source community is, number one, pretty good at least standardized numbering systems, but number two, not so good at updating them frequently, the reluctance to do so.
Well, it kind of depends, right? Some update so frequently it's annoying. I mean, I remember when I was a heavy MySQL user, or MeSQL.
Oh, gosh, yes,
you
that's
know,
true.
And it was like, oh, did they change something in it that's going to break something if I upgrade? And is indexing changing? Do I have to re-index a giant database just to upgrade? You know, things like that.
It's funny that you mentioned that because PHP was the same way.
Oh, yeah.
It was, okay, if I install the latest upgrade, will my website come tumbling down?
Or for me, going back to MySQL, for me, the thing I always used to have to install in test machines first, like you're supposed to. But if I install the new PHP, does MySQL admin die?
Yeah.
You know, or is it called PHP My Admin? I guess PHP My Admin.
Yeah.
And if PHP My Admin is dead, you might as well just cut my throat. Cause,
Oh, but there's a command line.
Yeah. Hey, again, just cut my throat. It's simpler and painless.
And for those of you that are still thinking about Apache, we've been on Apache 2 now for 16 years almost.
Yeah, but aren't we on like Apache 2? We're at 2.9 something now, right?
No, we're 2.4.
Oh, 2.4?
Yeah.
What am I thinking about 2.9?
And that was released in 2012. But here's the interesting thing. If you are a staunch old admin that will not upgrade from Apache 1.3...
They still got a path, least, right?
You still at least got upgrades until 2010.
Yeah.
So yeah. 8 years after 2.0 came out, you could still toe the line. And
well, it's like Python. You know, Python, it was such a dramatic leap from 2x to 3 that I think they still have a supported 2x line, a 2.9 point something. Jeez. Because stuff just breaks if you migrate to Python 3.
Well, and if we're going to talk about things just breaking with minor revisions, let's think about Ruby on Rails.
Oh.
Where if you're not using the exact version of something, there's no hope for you. I've got a project that was written 6 years ago. I don't even want it in Ruby and Rails anymore. I'm trying to hire a programmer to port it to another platform because the only place I can run it is in a virtual machine that's running Debian 6.
Well,
and I have a virtual machine specifically built for that purpose, for this one application.
Well, I will be honest with you. Whenever you look at any of the salary technology surveys, Ruby on Rails guys make a ton of money, and it's because of that reason. That they talk about a necessary, you know, evil. Once you're in with it, yeah, if you want to stay current, it can be brutal at times. You're right.
Well, it's
Ruby on Rails is just the Ponzi scheme of programming. I mean, you're just locked into it, and you're just paying. You're not paying any investment. You're just paying the next group of programmers that's going to have to come in.
To me, the scariest one was running Java Enterprise Edition. Oh. I mean, you know, if you had anything dependent on those runtimes, you know, Tomcat or something like that, and your runtime was updated and you didn't update Tomcat or whatever the heck you're running, yep, you were just doomed.
Yeah. And did you hear, I guess it was this week that the talk is up again that Oracle is considering finally just turning over Java EE to one of the open source groups.
I read that somewhere.
Yeah, that would be big. And it would probably make Google breathe a sigh of relief, I guess. One step further away from Java for
Android,
for Oracle.
Yeah.
Let's just also say, while we're on the subject of Java, if you have to deploy any software that has the word middleware in its name, you're having a bad day because you are gluing pieces together that are already unstable, and you're just it's basically the equivalent of Russian roulette software deployment at this point. So, yeah, the reason Oracle forms middleware to try to interface with a mainframe, that's just painful, painful, painful.
You know?
Yeah. We'll leave that for another episode of Mobile Views, and we can call it Middleware Views, because I can tell you some great stories about that, too.
Every time someone talks to me, they go, why is it that blank company, and they're always talking about a big utility of some sort, why is it they can never get my account information right, or why is it that my billing's all screwed up? Or why? I always explain to them, well, you see, there are people using modern computers, and they're trying to talk to a mainframe that company bought in earnest in 1960, and they are not upgrading. So don't even wonder why this is the case. Let me tell you, I changed my Verizon service plan today, and I'm amazed it went through. It's the first time it's ever gone through from the web interface.
Oh, my goodness.
And I still don't know if it'll go through. The plan change takes effect tomorrow. We'll see what happens.
Well, let's see.
You guys just gave me a new idea for a cartoon series that I could do called Java the Hutt, you know? But at any rate. Anyway, so we digress, but believe it or not, folks, if you forgot what we're talking about, this started because GIMP upgraded to 2.9.6.
We said we didn't care, but apparently we really do.
Yeah. Now, another thing that, you know, again, something I know very little about, and that's, you know, the blockchain stuff, Bitcoin and things. But this is, you know, I found this article in Digi Economist really interesting. Because I kind of wondered about this a while back. So the way Bitcoin is created is mined on computers that just kind of grind away at its algorithm to produce, you know, minuscule amounts of a fraction of a Bitcoin. And so, you know, people are running servers all over the world, server farms, creating Bitcoin. And there's a finite number of Bitcoins. I think it runs out in like 2040 or something, where it becomes like, you know, N Bitcoins and that's it. But I always wondered, boy, you know, these people are running, you know, these big server farms, or, you know, if you're running just a server in your home, you know, it can take up quite a bit of electricity for something that powerful. How much electricity does all of this use? And apparently, it's a significant amount. Like, if you compare the amount of electricity used by all the Bitcoin servers in the world that are grinding, or whatever they call them, mining machines, whatever they call them, mm-hmm. They're like a single-digit percentage of the total electricity produced by some countries. So it's pretty interesting. Yeah, so digeconomist.net. I'll have the link in the Mobile Views blog show notes for this episode. But really worth reading. How accurate is it? I don't know. But
it's,
you know,
yeah, it's an interesting that when you bring the subject up, because there's so many projects, and some of them very valid, worthwhile projects that rely on either server farms or share, you know, giving up a percentage of, you know, your own resources. I can remember the SETI at home.
Oh yeah.
Initiative as one. And it in the back of my mind, I always wondered, I mean, number one, obviously, how many computations are you actually able to accrue? How many people have you got on board with it? But yeah, what is the cost of doing that?
Yeah.
While most times we tend to think of the, yeah, when you mention Bitcoin and mining, we tend to think of the computational aspect of it. But everything has other costs, and like you said, energy is a cost too.
But if we
wonder wear and tear on what's wear and tear on, depending on how disk intensive operations are versus, it's fascinating. And yeah, I could see how Bitcoin mining could do some serious energy consumption. Yeah.
But if we had spent all of that on SETI at home, we wouldn't have the aliens that now inhabit our politicians.
Okay, so, we try to be not political on this show.
Message just got out there. Message just got out there.
Somebody.
yeah. So, you know, it was a success at least.
What was the name of that distributed system that we used to use to like download Red Hat distros and stuff?
Torrents?
BitTorrents. Yeah. I haven't looked at torrenting.
You speak of this as if they are dead.
Well, I guess I don't use it anymore. But
sure,
I used
people
to use,
that love for BitTorrent.
I used to use BitTorrent frequently because that's how I used to get my Red Hat and Fedora distros. Because basically, otherwise you'd overwhelm these poor servers at some little university. Well, little.
Yep.
Like you would overwhelm UC Berkeley's servers when the new Fedora came out. So I'd BitTorrent them down. It'd take a while, take like a day, but at least I wasn't killing somebody's server, I felt. So, but you needed those things.
Killing a lot of people's servers with a little bit of pain.
Yeah. Well, I used to share some of my disk space too, to, you know, kind of give back to the community. So I had a small little PC, Linux PC set up to handle Linux distro BitTorrenting back in the day. Just to, like I said, to kind of give back, I thought. But anyway.
You were mentioning early Linux distros earlier on. I was the same. I had an office down in Miami in the early to mid 90s, and I had one PC set up as a Linux box.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing. It served multiple purposes for me. And one of them was to, you know, occasionally if I needed to do anything with torrent based, it was used for that. So yeah, it is interesting how all these things, you know, like I said, the distributed computing, like there's tons of benefits to it, but you always, in the back of my head, I'm always thinking about what the costs are too.
Yeah. So anywho, that was that, or the Bitcoin. No, okay. Now I think John has a rant coming up. So.
Well, let's just say that I have 3.9 terabytes of data that I now need to find a home for after August of next year, because Crash Plan has decided that they're a ridiculously good deal, and it honestly was. For 10 computers, $150 a year, all you can back up, was ridiculously a good deal. But they've decided they're not going to offer that anymore.
To consumers.
Yes, to consumers. They will gladly take more of your money if you would like to do that. But this is... So I've been thinking about it, and I think next year, once the clock is closer and ticking, I'll probably just start building my own network-attached storage. But I'm actually thinking about doing this all open source and having some plan for backup that at least I know all the pieces of, because all the proprietary stuff, there's always these secret sauces, and you don't quite know exactly how things are backed up.
You know, so. It's funny, because you and a couple of our other mutual friends recommended CrashPlan to me. About a couple of years ago, when my daughter was an undergrad, and I never bit the bullet. She had OneDrive, she had an educational OneDrive account, which gave her a terabyte of backups. I figured, use that. Never moved to it. I was about, now that she's in grad school, I almost pulled the trigger a few months ago, before she went back to school, to get her on CrashPlan. But her grad school has Office 365 account, so she's got another terabyte. A new terabyte to deal with. So I said, that'll work for a while. I'll think about it for until Christmas, maybe. And then, of course, this happened. Now, that said, a couple of our other friends have recommended Backblaze as an alternative. So, that's something else for you to consider.
It's interesting because I was in the basically a combination of you, John, and then Todd. I went to what Todd talked about. I had been crash planned. But after a lot of analysis, I started to realize the fact that basically what I needed was system recovery, and backing up of digitally downloaded apps and data. And so for the former, I have recovery disks for my computers. And for the latter, I ended up going to OneDrive just because as an Office 365, I've got a terabyte. To work from. And I found, I think it really comes down to volume. In my case, that was able to account for me. If I was, I would even say 5 years ago with a lot of other things I was doing, probably that might not be enough. But it's funny, the third option that you talk about is when it comes to building a NAS and open source, there's some great customized Linux distros around storage arrays and NASs that and years back that was my other thing before CrashPlan was I actually had a NAS that was here in the house that was enough for what I needed at the time.
Well, my plan now is because what I really have liked with CrashPlan is the version control. Where I can go back if something got screwed up and grab something from a certain day, recovering deleted files. Even if I, it's almost one of those things of just the ease of use. I know I put that file somewhere, but it was on my desktop 3 weeks ago, so let's go grab it and just recover it from there. So what I think I'll probably end up with, and I did like having offsite. That was a big deal for me.
Yeah.
So what my plan is now is build this NAS unit, do the initial backup on my network, and then drag it to work or somewhere where I have another, somewhere away from the original copy of the data for trickle backups and things like that over time. So
well, you're someplace where you don't have to worry necessarily. Your offsite backup strategy doesn't have to be like another part of the state. It's funny, we were mentioning earlier about hurricanes and Hurricane Andrew back in 92. I was I basically volunteered. People were offering so many services. I basically offered some free consulting volunteering, and I could tell you the horror stories of businesses that had an offsite backup strategy that. One of the IT guys at that point, a lot of them were still called data processing. One of the DP guys would take the tapes to his house, which was 20 miles away from the office, and both got leveled by Hurricane Andrew, and their backups were gone as well as their systems. So it does come down to you're right. From a backup, we always used to say from a disaster recovery, and that's the database administrator for me decades ago too. Your disaster recovery strategy is only as good or as bad as A, your worst case scenario, and B, how you account for that worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. In your case, John, yeah, I think you're pretty safe, although make sure it's put up high so you don't flood if you get a lot of rain.
You know, the other thing...
It'll be on the second or third floor of a building. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The other thing that might be interesting, John, is if you use something like Amazon's, what is it called, Iceberg Storage or whatever? So it's
Amazon Glacier.
Yeah, Glacier. So you.
Yeah, I've thought about that. You know, and I actually have a one of the machines that I still am the admin for is on Amazon Web Services. We finally moved it over there earlier this year from a physical machine. So I might actually play around with that, because that machine, ironically, is now backing up to CrashPlan. So I have to figure out a place for it to go
It might be interesting to have a hyperlocal solution with your own NAS and then back it up to Glacier, you know, for nearline access. Nearline, but remote and, you know, presumably safe.
I think with Whole Foods acquisition, this is going to be named from Amazon Iceberg to Amazon Iceberg Lettuce.
There you go.
And your backups will actually be stored in the produce section of your nearest, which, John, is still way off-site for you, your nearest Whole Foods location. Matt,
and I don't know if you're quite aware of just how much I detest iceberg lettuce. So, I mean, I am of the opinion that I could say a lot of nasty things about iceberg lettuce, but it's... It is not my friend in many ways. I'll have to send you my...
Well, I think iceberg lettuce, like romaine lettuce, has no nutritional value.
Exactly.
If I remember correctly. And, you know, for those of us with vegetarian animals, they specifically tell you not to serve that because it has no nutritional value for the animals.
Great. A diet of strictly lettuce is not a good thing.
Well, not to get into, you know, pet views today, but anything that has a reddish color tends to be more nutritious, have more nutritional value for people and other, you know, critters. Things that don't have red in them, probably not so much. But anyway, from the leafy vegetables. But anyway, this is not nutritionist view today, so... there we go. The other thing I was thinking is, you know, if they put all the data centers in remote, northern, the more northern Whole Foods, then they can heat up the Whole Foods with the servers.
That's true. That's true.
So, anywho. Okay. So, any rate, So Don, I did not pull the trigger on CrashPlan, so it doesn't affect me. I know several people who are really, really annoyed at this point. I know you're smiling, so it looks like you're okay. John is not smiling.
John's the one with the frowny face now.
And 3 terabytes of data.
I will survive. The data is all here. I'm looking at it right now. It's just got to find another home for its backup. And I do have until next August.
Well, you know,
I am happy about that.
Yeah, if we had the license, the music license for it, we would play Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive for you right now. Those of you who can stream, go ahead and stream it now for John, and everybody will feel better. But at any rate, it is not a laughing matter for people with terabytes of data backed up on this thing. But, you know, that's the problem with the cloud, right? The cloud's strength is it's, generally speaking, cheap and plentiful until it's not. Yeah. And it's really hard to tell who's going to... Because, like, Google is infamous for pulling great services that you come to depend on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, absolute trust is something that just doesn't exist when it comes to the cloud at this point. It can't.
Yeah.
Because even in the best of circumstances, and what you would think to be the most reliable of circumstances, we see.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, absolutely. All right.
But in happier news, as I put at the end of our show notes, I am starting to get a little bit of the potential new shiny thing excitement over and debating whether, because as I've mentioned, I did buy an iPhone 7 Plus last year. It's my daily driver, but I am cursing myself for getting the 32 gig version. I think I was just especially masochistic that day and hated myself and decided to go with that. So I have a semi-legit reason to consider upgrading to the 8.
excuse.
I've also been wearing my Apple Watch original edition since it came out, so I'm excited to see what might get announced in a couple weeks. So at least that's making it a little less annoying, the whole crash plan issue.
Well, that brings up a question I have for Don. So, Don, what current phone are you using, and are you using any kind of smartwatch or using a Fitbit band or one of those things?
Great question. And as usual, the answer is yes and all of the above and all over the place. I'm all over the map. I do have an iPhone 7, and I have the 32 gig, John, but I'll be 100% honest with you. For what I do, I keep, for example, for the gym, I keep a few, a playlist or two from Spotify offline in case I don't have. But I'm also on T-Mobile with Binge On, so I stream the living daylights out of so much. So it doesn't hit me as badly. I also have an Android phone that's getting a little long in the tooth, an Asus Zen phone. And I have that because it's a dual SIM, which has worked really well. I've had to keep a work line and a personal line. And on the wearable side, I have had Fitbit. As a matter of fact, I have a Surge. But I also have got a while back the Moto 360 Sport Android Wear watch, which thankfully before the turn of the next century, finally got Android Wear 2 just yesterday. Motorola finally released Android Wear 2 for the Moto 360 Sport.
Right, they released the second generation.
Second gen.
Yeah.
But they hadn't done it for the Sport. So, as a matter of fact, I just found out, interestingly enough, I had been wearing the Surge. And I did my, like, once a week, I check in, I do a quick search on Google, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's available. Oh, sure. Time to switch again. So, yeah, I just downloaded it. I have it installed. So, I love my wearables.
A Nexus 6, which cannot be upgraded anymore. In fact, it didn't even get UGAW 7.1. I think it's stuck at 7.0.
Everything can get upgraded in the Android world. It's just how legitimate is the upgrade?
Right, right. Well, let me put it this way. For the official upgrade path.
Right.
And similarly, I have the first generation. Unlike you, I have the first generation Moto 360, which cannot get Android Wear 2.0. Yeah. So, but the thing is, it's funny, as John and I have been talking for, a couple of years now about our smartwatches, I really don't do much with it. I mean, let me rephrase that. I don't do much with it that requires a third party installation of anything. It is perfect the way it comes out of the box for me, which is weird. Usually I'm adding apps to everything, but for the watch, what do I need? I need notifications. I need to know the time. I need a connectivity to the maps every now and then if, I'm going somewhere unfamiliar. Yep. That's pretty much it.
It's fascinating because what I found, the I'm just getting a visual cue from John here. And today seems to be nostalgia day, apparently, for all of us. We've been talking about things that are old.
Yeah,
I just don't want Todd to cry. That's
don't make me cry. Don't bring up the spot watch.
Well, it's funny, though, because it's the tough part is, like, I give you, for example, the Fitbit Surge, which we're let's throw aside the aesthetics of its design, which obviously the folks at Fitbit weren't big on aesthetics when it came to the actual look. But what I find is it's a very good health and fitness wearable, but it comes a little bit short when you want it to integrate with, say, your phone. Now flip over to your Android Wear. Most of those are really good when it comes to notifications integration with Android. But on the fitness side, they come up short. I will say the best that I've seen has been the Moto 360 Sport.
Well, I have to go ahead, Don.
Yeah, I find that that one's the closest. But it is. It's a constant battle. When somebody asks me, which do you prefer? I'm like, it's not. It's tough. I find myself in a constant struggle going, especially as somebody who's very active with workouts, the gym, and things like that. I'm sort of like, which one should I wear? Which one should I use? But in the end, I kind of like the other thing, too, that's interesting. You mentioned Apple Watches. I think the Apple Watch overall, in a lot of ways, is superior than the Android Wear watches, with one exception. And that is the Android Wear watches, I can run, albeit limited, I can run it with an iOS device and still get some usefulness out of it. And the Apple Watch is the one frustration with it is you want to use it, you're locked again into the iOS ecosystem.
Yep.
But but no, that being said, I think I think what I've seen from the Apple Watch is I've been impressed. As a matter of fact, I think they may be superior than anything Android Wear has put out from any of the manufacturers when it comes to the fitness aspect.
That's probably true. I was going to say that, you know, when I first got my Moto 360, I did turn on the fitness stuff, you know, to track steps and things like that. Uh-huh. I'm not an athlete by any stretch of the imagination. But I do keep track of my steps and things because, you know, being a geek, I find numbers fun. But the thing is, it killed my battery. And so, you know, of the watch. So I had to just, after a couple of days of my watch dying before dinner, I said, well, it's, you know, it's not much use of tracking things if it's dead before dinner. So,
yeah. Well, interestingly enough, in all fairness, I find the same problem. One of the first things I do with any of the Fitbit devices, especially like the Surge, the more sophisticated ones, is turn off the all-day sync, as they like to call it, which is a persistent behind-the-scenes connection with Bluetooth and push. Because does the same thing. My Fitbit Surge, if I leave it on the all-day sync constantly in the background, it's a wearable device that you're supposed to wear to sleep, but you need to charge it daily when you've got all day sync on.
Right.
So
And in fact, I may have to do that because I have the Fitbit One Ultra, whatever the last one that you could put in your pocket was. And they've never upgraded it since then. But and it's been great. I've had it for a couple of years now, but the battery seems to be getting a little. I mean, you know, I've been charging it for 3 years now, so. You kind of got to expect the rechargeable battery to lose its you know, charge level. I used to be able to go 4 or 5 days without charging it.
Wow.
Now I'm charging it maybe every other day. Maybe I have to turn off the, you know, all-day sync, which I don't know why I find it interesting, but I just do.
It's simple enough. What I do is at regular points through the day, I just open up the Fitbit app on my phone, and the synchronization takes place then. I find it, and I'm sure it probably varies from device to device.
Okay.
But I'm sure that in some cases, like I said, in the case of the Surge, it made a major difference in terms of.
Okay, I just turned off all day sync. We'll see if it helps.
I'll be curious. Curious to see if that helps. But yeah, it's interesting, John. The iPhone 8 has some. Incredibly compelling features, obviously, we'll find out, officially confirmed shortly. But it also has some incredibly non-compelling things like what we're hearing rumored for price.
Well, $1,000. Of course, that's what the Galaxy Note 8 is, right?
Yeah. And for the longest time, I've been Samsung treats the Android market like they were the only game, like Apple treats they are the iOS.
They're not far from it, though. Don't they have like 85% of the Android smartphone market or something like that?
Yeah, but it's a dangerous game to play when there is so much competition. I mean, the bottom line is Apple can do what they want to do. You know, granted, yes, they have other platforms to compete against, but within their own platform, they're king and master. You know, Samsung, I question, you know, at what point do you start to make people go, whoa, you know, especially when they can turn and look. I mean, don't get me wrong, you pay a price with some of the low-end models, but T-Mobile just introduced, for example, what is it, the Revel, which is their T-Mobile branded, but it's actually an Alcatel device, And it's supposed to be a pretty decent device. And T-Mobile's selling it for $125 flat out, wow, or zero down and $5 a month, wow, for like, you know, yeah. And it's running Android Nougat. It's running 7 right now. You look at what, you know, what is it GHB or HGB Global, which the Nokia brand, mm-hmm, who owns a Nokia brand, pushing out a Nokia phone with, again, decent specs, hmm, with the 6 model. Nothing spectacular, but under $200.
Hmm.
I have to question it. I think it's a little bit – it's going to be interesting to see if there's a little bit of too much hubris in Samsung thinking they are the iOS of Android and that they can charge whatever they want and people are going to flock, mm-hmm, to it. It's getting – to the point where there's such a huge price discrepancy between Samsung and the rest of the Android vendors that it might catch up to them.
And we haven't even been far enough out to know if the thing truly doesn't explode.
Yeah. I'm sure
that's probably the selling point with the Note 8, but you know, it took a while for the Note 7 to start having its issues. So
yeah, no, I just when I saw the pricing on this, and don't get me wrong, the S8 and the S8 Plus are no cheap.
Neither is the iPhone 7 Plus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and again, it's when you have such a discrepancy in price, people will start to say, I wouldn't be surprised if people say, yeah, I might be sacrificing this or that, but at that huge price difference, I'm willing to make the sacrifices.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out for the Note 8. I really, when I saw its pricing, I'm like, wow, is this possibly the turning point? Especially when you're starting to see, like I said, I just mentioned a couple of them. HTC is still pricey, but not nearly as pricey. And the U11 is supposed to be a fantastic device. The hardware is gorgeous. It's only a matter of time before you start to see more penetration from, Huawei? You start to see some of the Asian vendors make more of an impact here. Yeah. It is a market that lends itself primarily in Android to lesser costs. So to try to price yourself high can bite you in the you know what.
Yeah. Well, as a Google Fi user, I got to wait for whatever is compatible with it. So.
Yeah,
I can't consider anything except whatever Google, you know, blesses, yeah, as compatible with Google.
And speaking of on the radar, I mean, we're talking iPhone 8, which we're expecting announcements soon.
Yep.
Now, rumor has it that we're going to get our Pixel announcements, you know, Pixel 2 announcements very soon as well, which will be interesting to see again. Does Google do the same thing, and price it as a Cadillac?
Well, they did last time, and when I bought the Nexus 6, which is what I'm still using, it was the low end, which is what I bought, 32 gigs, I think, was $650.
Yeah.
Not exactly cheap. I mean, cheaper than an iPhone, I guess, but not that much.
The Pixel was very expensive, and as a result, I mean, they never sold massive numbers of it. There were... being as somebody who works on the enterprise side of things, I had heard, and nothing came to, I can't validate it as absolute fact, but there were some folks that felt that the pricing was more and put in line for the Pixel line to be sold in conjunction with Google and the enterprise.
Right.
So they priced it more of it like an enterprise type device. But again, you're back to the same problem. Enterprises don't all just run out and pay list plus, for devices. If anything, what we've learned from the PC market is a lot of times they go for volume at a reduced price.
Yep.
So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see after a couple of iterations, like you said, the 6 and the Pixel, what happens pricing-wise with the Pixel too.
Yep. Okay, gang. Well, I am going to close out this Mobile Views podcast. I want to thank John, my regular co-host as usual, and Don for joining us for a podcast. We'll do this again next time.